Hey, what are we, are you at breakfast yet or lunch?
Neither.
Well, let's go down to the garden district. It's not the studio, really. It's just, I guess we felt we do things a lot better when we were rehearsing. And, more comfortable. Yeah.
Well, you just leaving tape running while you're doing your rehearsal?
Yeah. And then when we all feel one that we all think is good, listen to it. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot cheaper and faster that way, too, right? Yeah. Because you wreck the equipment, then you can use it very important. Just so you can pay $1,000 a day. You should run into a studio,
right?
Right. This one. This will be the first record we're actually doing without a producer. We use the same engineer that we've always had, Bruce Botnick. I don't know if he'll be called a producer or not. No, a co-producer. So we're trying to get this erased because it's that good to have something like that on your record, man. It's just if something really serious happened, then you'd have a record and it makes it a lot worse. You know? Uh-huh. And actually, we were acquitted because the stewardesses mistook me for someone else, so that was good.
Can you take a table?
Oh yeah, sure. They were saying the person in such a seat was causing all this trouble, and then they all identified me as being in another seat, so... They were just trying to hang me, you know, because I was the only one that was had a well-known face or something, so they were trying to get me for it. I don't know, I guess as an example of the people that behave in airplanes. So. The trouble with all these busts is people that I know, friends of mine, think it's really funny and they like to believe it's true, so they just... They accept it, and people that don't like me want to believe it because it's an incarnation of everything they consider evil. So I get hung both ways. You know? Anybody want a cocktail before you order? We're going to contend with on several grounds. First of all, they never really proved anything except profanity, which we admitted all along, that there was profanity used in the performance. And we were going to attempt to prove that that did not violate contemporary community standards in the city of Miami. And to do that, we were going to take the jury to see a lot of movies, like Woodstock, and Hair was playing in town at that time, and they had nudity on stage every night, and they were allowing young people to go in of any age, and all the books that were available, even in school libraries, junior high school libraries, with four-letter words. So the judge refused to allow any investigation along those lines and limited it to a criminal action. Well, they brought on about 13 witnesses. Every witness was either a policeman who was working there that night or someone who worked for the city and happened to be there, or a relative of a policeman. In fact, that was their biggest witness, was a 16-year-old girl who was the niece of a police officer who got her and her date in free that night. They had thousands of photographs from many different people that were there, and there was no photograph of an exposure or anything near it. And the other charges, I think they just put in there to make it look more serious, you know, simulated masturbation and oral copulation. Yeah, masturbation on myself and oral copulation on the guitar player.
For sure. There's a picture of that in the inside sleeve of that Best Hits album. That was their big proof, you know. It's a real lamb. That guy, Lewis Marvin, you know, the Moonfire, he happened to be down there. He travels around spreading his philosophy of nonviolence and vegetarianism. And he carried this little lamb around to demonstrate his principles. In other words, if you eat meat, you know you're killing this little lamb. So he gave it to me during the middle of the show, and I just held him for a while. It was really interesting that there was a lot of noise and a lot of commotion. It was almost deafening in the auditorium, but the lamb was breathing normally, almost purring like a kitten. It was very completely relaxed. I guess what they say about lambs to the slaughter is true, you know? They don't feel a thing. Anyway, the judge limited the defense's witnesses. We had 300 witnesses who were there, and we were going to parade them all in to get their side of it. He limited the defense to the number of witnesses that the prosecution brought on, which is an entirely arbitrary maneuver. But we had over 300 people that were willing to testify, and they were there. Didn't see anything of any of those alleged incidents. What it turns out that actually happened was a journalist happened to be there or heard about this concert. And the next day he went and wrote a sensational front page story about the concert, about inciting the riot. And the citizens became irate and began calling the police station asking why this had been allowed to go on and why wasn't I arrested. And I'd gotten up and gone on to Jamaica for a holiday that had been planned down there. And so about 3 or 4 days after the whole thing, they swore out a warrant for me. So you can kind of see how the whole thing, you know, began. The only one we did during the trial went on for 2 months. Not really. They might have, but we just went ahead and did a few things. Like, but actually, the only thing I did was to fly to the Isle of Wight for a day, and then I came right back. We could have done it, but really, we never knew from one day to the next when court was in session. And he changed it every day, so we never knew. So to have flown somewhere for a couple days, I really needed the weekends to rest up, you know. It was kind of an ordeal. I think it was really a lifestyle that they were going after. I don't think it was me personally. I just kind of stepped into a hornet's nest. I had no idea that the sentiment down there was so tender. The audience that was there really enjoyed it. You know, it was, I think people reading about it in the paper, this distorted version created a climate of hysteria. And then a few weeks later, they had an anti-indecency rally at the Orange Bowl with a famous fat comedian as MC. So I wasted a lot of time and energy on that thing, but about a year and a half of kind of a gnawing disquiet about it. But I guess it was a valuable experience because I think before the trial I had a very unrealistic schoolboy attitude about the American judicial system, and my eyes have been opened up a little bit. There were guys down there, black guys, that would go on each day before I'd go on, like for it'd take about 5 minutes and they'd get 20, 30 years in jail, you know. If I hadn't had unlimited funds to continue fighting my case, I'd be in jail right now for 3 years. It's just, if you got money, you generally don't go to jail. It's about... I felt like a spectator, but I wouldn't have wanted to defend myself because I would have blown it, I'm sure. It's not as easy as it looks, you know. I didn't have to testify, but we decided it might be a good thing for the jury to see what I was like, because all they could do is look at me for 6 weeks or whatever it was. So I testified a couple of days. I don't think it meant anything one way or the other. I saw half of it, but I was so uncomfortable I couldn't sit through the rest of it. Not that I don't appreciate satire. I like satire, but it just hit too close to home. You know, it made me real edgy, so I had to get up and split. But I enjoy their work. Especially that maze ritual they have on Sunday. The Liquid Theater, that's one of the most interesting things they do. I don't know very many of them personally, but I've been attending their things off and on for a couple of years. I'm glad and amazed that they managed to keep going. I mean, that's great. I think people enjoy being in crowds. It gives them a feeling of power and security in a strange way. They like to rub up against hundreds of other people that are like them. It kind of reinforces their truth. It's just to be a focus for everyone's attention, because you have to have an excuse to mob together. You can't just, otherwise it'd just be, what would you call it? That would be a riot or something, wouldn't it? We never really had any riots. I mean, a riot's more out of control, violent thing. We never had too much what I'd call a real riot. I think it also... it has something to do with swarming theory. The idea that an insect and animal species, when the food supply, the population starts outstripping the food supply, the animals or insects swarm together. It's a way of communicating and working out a solution, or making each other, signaling their awareness that there is a danger. And in nature, somehow a balance is worked out, and I think that's what, for example, in LA or New York, in many big cities, you feel crowded. You feel psychologically crowded and just physically crowded. People are getting very neurotic and paranoid. And I guess things like rock concerts are a form of human swarming to communicate this unease about overpopulation. I was trying to get everybody to do that about a year ago, and no one wanted to, and now they kind of want to, and I've totally lost interest. Although, I know it's a lot of fun, but I just don't have the desire to get up and sing much. I still enjoy music, but I don't really, kind of lost my interest for it. The Highway's the only really film I did. The others were more I was actively involved in them, but they weren't really totally my film. But The Highway is, to a large degree. I always see films as a team effort, you know, except in rare cases. But yeah, I'd like to get Highway shown. I think maybe it might work in educational television, NET. It's about the right length. You see, it's an uncommercial type film. And it's too long for a short to play with another feature, and it's not a feature itself. 50 minutes. So it's an awkward length. I don't know. I think maybe educational TV might be a good spot for it. There's no story, really, no real narrative, except there's a hitchhiker who we don't see it, but then we later assume that he stole a car. And drives into the city. And then it just ends there. As he gets into the city, checks into a motel, and goes out to a nightclub or somewhere. And it just kind of ends like that. I had always been fascinated with a story about a hitchhiker who becomes a mass murderer. And I set out to make that film, but it turned into a different film, a much more subtle fantasy. Someday I'd still like to make that hitchhiker film, though, because I think it's a good one. I just meant that I think in art, but especially in films, people are trying to confirm their own existence. Somehow they seem more real. Somehow things seem more real if they can be photographed and, you know, if you can create a semblance of life on a screen. But, you know, those little aphorisms that make up most of the lores, if I could have said it any other way, I would have, you know. They're kind of to be mulled over and not taken too seriously, but I did most of that book when I was at the film school at UCLA, and it was really a thesis on film aesthetics, because I wasn't able to make films then, so all I could do was think about them and write about them, and that's probably, it probably reflects a lot of that. But then a lot of the passages in it, for example about shamanism, turned out to be very prophetic several years later, because I had no idea when I was writing that, but that's what I'd be doing, but that's what it turned into. Really, what that book is a lot about is the feeling of powerlessness and helplessness people have in the face of reality, that they have no real control over events or their own lives, that something is controlling it. But the closest they ever get to it is on a television set. But in creating this idea of the Lords, it also, I think, came to reverse itself. And now to me, the Lords means something entirely different. I couldn't quite explain it. But almost the opposite of that. You know, somehow the Lords are a romantic race of people who have found a way to control their environment and their own lives. They're somehow different from other people. I had a book on snakes and reptiles. And the first sentence of it struck me very acutely. It goes, reptiles are the interesting descendants of magnificent ancestors. And another thing about them is they're a complete anachronism. If every reptile in the world were to disappear tomorrow, it wouldn't really change the balance of nature one bit. They're completely arbitrary species. And I think maybe they might, you know, if any creature could survive another world war or some kind of some kind of total poisoning of the planet, I think somehow reptiles would find a way to make it. Also, we must not forget that the lizard and the snake are also identified with the unconscious and with the forces of evil. You know, they're the devil's gang. The reptiles are. And that piece, The Celebration of the Lizard, was kind of a invocation of dark forces. But it's all done tongue-in-cheek. I don't think people ever realize that, but it's not really serious, you know. Uh-huh. It's just... like, if you play a villain in a Western, that doesn't mean that that's you. I mean, that's just an aspect that you choose to show, you know. So I don't really take that seriously. Also, you know, and on a much more basic level, I've just always loved reptiles, horned toads. I grew up in the Southwest for part of my life, and I used to catch horned toads and lizards, and of course snakes are, I still can't get too near snakes somehow. They still have kind of a, I mean, it's hard for me to pick up a snake and play with it. Some people can do it quite easily. But there's something deep in the human memory that responds strongly to snakes.
Yeah.
You know, they're probably...
it's a childhood dream, and all those snakes, you know, in one form or another.
Even if you've never seen one, you have like a dragon, you know, St. George and the dragon. I think a snake just embodies probably everything we fear, you know. And but also, you know, basically their skins are just beautiful. You know, I guess that's why they become so fashionable, and I think they always have been. You know, but it's interesting because that book was mainly written when I was very naive, so it wasn't something that was born out of a you know, any great awareness of the universe or anything. It was a very naive little book, you know. Somehow, for me, it holds up, a lot of it. Well, it always amazes me that people think you're 2 years younger than you are, you know. I guess that's why you have to keep doing interviews. You know, it's like seeing baby pictures or something. It's kind of embarrassing and funny at the same time. Interviews, I've always said about what I thought, you know, but just people believe old press clippings or something, you know. And remember a couple years ago when all that stuff was going on? Well, people still remember all that, you know. I think it fulfilled a need people had, you know, for some figure who would represent a lot of things, so they created this thing.
I had a good time.
You know, I think more than writing music and as a singer, any of that, I think my greatest talent was for, I had an instinctive knack for self-image propagation. You know, I was very good at manipulating publicity, just with a few little phrases like that, because having grown up on television and mass magazines and all that, I knew instinctively what people would attach onto, and so I just dropped these little jewels here and there, very innocently and.
People
seemingly innocently, and of course, you know, it was like just calling signals, you know. No, I think we were very timely. The music and some of the ideas are very timely. They seem kind of naive now, but I remember a couple of years ago, people were into some very weird things. You know, there was a high energy level, and you could say things like that and almost half-ass believe it, you know. Whereas now it seems very naive. And No, I think it was a combination of good musicianship and timeliness. Mm-hmm. And we may have been one of the first groups to come along that were openly self-conscious about being performers. In other words, reflecting on our own career as it was happening. It's not that we were trend conscious, we were doing exactly what we would have done anyway, but it came at the right time when you could get away with expressing sentiments like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I'm sure we would have done the same thing anyway. Well, for example, the first album is not really socially conscious at all. It's just very universal, personal statements. And then each one, we got a little more socially aware, you know, of the whole landscape. And perhaps to the detriment of the music, I'm not sure. Although there were a couple of... I never thought of any of the songs as being political in that sense. They were more... really, they could, as we traveled around and played to large groups of people, then some of the words couldn't help reflecting the things that I ran into, you know, traveling around. That was mainly it. It wasn't any conscious program. But in answer to your original question, I think that probably the things we'll record now get back to the blues, essentially, is what we do best. Is blues, and I think we may even do a couple old blues and some blues of our own. And so, just your basic blues. You know, it'll be good blues. It won't be like it won't be like a guy with a guitar playing the blues. It'll be electric blues, you know. But blues, nevertheless. I hope. You know, you never know. When you start an album, you have one idea, and it could end up entirely different. But that's what I'm going to push for, is that's the music I enjoy doing the best. It's the most fun to sing. I like jazz also, but you don't need a singer really for jazz. But those guys really, they ought to do some instrumentals. I've always pushed for that, but they've been reluctant to do it. I wish they would. For three guys, you know, with a drummer and just two instruments, these guys put out a lot of music, you know, a lot of sound, and it's... Well, I like any kind of reaction I can get, so I enjoy it. Just anything to get, I guess, to get people to think, you know. I mean, if you can get a whole room, a whole club full of drunk, stoned people to actually wake up from it, I mean, you're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not what they come here for. It's to just to lose themselves, you know. I got an instinctive feeling for the film media. I think I'll do pretty good at it. Well, see, I like that kind of thing because... I never thought that an audience should be as passive as they become, and so let's just, I think an audience should be an active participant in creating what's happening, and you can even do that with a film, you know. For example, it's up to you to close your eyes anytime you want. Or get up and walk out for 5 minutes and come back, and that makes an entirely different movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Than what a person would see if they just sat dutifully through it from beginning to end. We'd made this film that we thought was really neat, and no one wanted to distribute it or anything, so we just show it whenever we could. Because it was worth seeing, you know, and I'm glad we made it. It'll be a good document of that era. I think I may get a chance to make a film because of that notoriety I'll probably get one chance, you know, and if it doesn't really make it, I probably, it'll be very hard to get another chance. But I think almost anybody can get one chance these days to make some kind of film. They always want a soundtrack or something, you know, or even have the audacity to want you to play a singer in a movie, to play yourself in a movie. So I'm not really interested in acting. It doesn't bother me that much. I kind of came along when rock and roll, the old rock and roll was the big thing, and like I guess a lot of people knocked me out. And then I discovered blues in college. I like that. And these, if I'm ever gonna listen to anything these days, it's I like jazz. So, but man, there's just so much music. You can't. It's like swimming in a sea of marshmallows or something. You can't follow. The only thing I've heard is the thing since Zabriskie Point is the beginning and the end, and they knocked me out. And I've heard a few. Oh, I heard them in Hyde Park. I happened to be in London when they were. They did a free concert in Hyde Park. I could listen to them a lot. In fact, when I heard them and when I heard Miles a few times at the Manhole and at the Isle of Wight, I couldn't believe that he got it together to do the Isle of Wight. And I mean, I thought it was good. This new sound he has now. When I heard those two things, I said to myself, well. See, I'm not a musician, so I wouldn't know how to. All I knew was there was something there, and I figured if we couldn't go in that direction, you know, and get complex like that, then best for us to do what we can really do best, which is blues. I don't think we'll ever. It would. I don't know. I guess Pink Floyd's been together quite a while doing that kind of music, haven't they? They're not an overnight thing. Of course, Miles is, you know, music's been his whole life, so I guess you can't get into that thing overnight. But I have a friend, a girl, that's married to a friend of mine, and she only sings for friends. And I think if she ever performed publicly or on record, she'd be one of the great singers. I won't say any more about it, but there are nothing like a good female singer, you know? There are not that many. I mean, the ones that I like, personally. I don't know a thing about jazz. But for me, what it means is a kind of music that's based on improvising, in which you start out a set and you have an idea of the steps that it might go through, but it could turn it into something different. And when I see, to me there's a show, where they know exactly what they're going to do every step, and they come out and do a lot of songs. And then there's another type of music where you can feel the musicians reaching, and that's the kind that I appreciate.